Villon-sur-Salt, July 29, 1914. 1. It is pouring in Villon. The Sarthe swells against its banks, and the rain turns footpaths into muddy rivers. It spills over doorways, fills her ears with the steady white noise of rushing water, and when Addie closes her eyes, the years dissolve, and she is 10 again. She is 15. She is 20, her skirts wet and hair flying behind her as she races barefoot through a countryside washed clean. But then she opens her eyes again, and it has been 200 years, and she cannot deny that the little village of Villon has changed. She recognizes less and less, finds more and more strange. Here and there, she can still make out the place that she once knew, but her memories are threadbare, those years before her deal left to weather and fade. And yet, some things are constant. The stretch of road that runs through the town, the small church sitting in the center, the low wall of the graveyard, immune to the slow procession of change. Addie lingers in the chapel doorway, watching the storm. She had an umbrella when she started out, but a sharp gust of wind bent the frame, and she knows she should wait for the rain to ease, that she has only the one dress. But as she stands there, one hand held out to cup the falling water, she thinks of Estelle, who used to stand beneath the storms, arms wide and welcoming. Addie abandons her shelter and heads for the cemetery gate. In moments, she is soaked, but the rain is warm and she will hardly melt. She passes a few new headstones and many old, sets a wild rose on each of her parents' graves, and goes to find Estelle. She has missed the old woman these many years, missed her comfort and her counsel, missed the strength of her grip and her woody laugh and the way she believed in Addie when she was Adeline, when she was still here, still human. And even though she holds on to what she can, Estelle's voice has all but vanished with the passing years. This is the one place she can still conjure it, her presence felt in the old stones, the weedy earth, the weathered tree over her head. But the tree is not there. The grave slumps, weary in its plot, the stone moldering and cracked, but the beautiful tree, with its wide limbs and its deep roots, is gone. Nothing but a jagged stump remains. Addie lets out an audible gasp, sinking to her knees, runs her hands over the dead and splintered wood. No, no, not this. She has lost so much and mourned it all before, but for the first time in years, she is struck with a loss so sharp it steals her breath, her strength, her will. Grief, deep as a well, opens inside her. What is the point in planting seeds? Why tend them? Why help them grow? Everything crumbles in the end. Everything dies. And she is all that's left, a solitary ghost hosting a vigil for forgotten things. She squeezes her eyes shut and tries to conjure Estelle, tries to summon the old woman's voice so she can tell her it will be all right, that it's just wood. But the voice is gone, lost beneath the raging storm. Addie is still sitting there at dusk. The rain has slowed to a drizzle, the occasional tap of water against stone. She is soaked through, but she cannot feel it anymore, cannot feel much of anything, until she feels the shifting air and the arrival of the shadow at her back. "I'm sorry," he says, and it is the first time she has ever heard those words in that silken voice, the only time they will ever sound honest. "Did you do this?" she whispers without looking up. And to her surprise, Luke kneels beside her on the sodden earth. His own clothes do not seem to dampen.
"You cannot blame me for every loss," he says.
She doesn't realize she is shivering until his arm folds around her shoulders, until she feels her limbs trembling against the steady weight of his.
"I know I can be cruel," he says, "but nature can be crueler." It is obvious now, the charred line along the center of the stump, the swift, hot shear of lightning. It doesn't ease the loss. She cannot stand to look upon the tree. She cannot bear to linger here any longer. "Come," he says, drawing her to her feet, and she does not know where they are going, and she does not care, so long as it is somewhere else. Addie turns her back on the ruined stump, the tombstone worn to nothing. Even rocks, she thinks, as she follows Luke away from the graveyard and the village and the past. She will never go back. Paris, of course, has changed far more than Villon. Over the years, she has seen it polished to a shine, white stone buildings capped with charcoal roofs, long windows and iron balconies, and wide avenues lined with flower shops and cafes beneath red awnings. They sit on a patio, her dress drying in the summer breeze, a bottle of port open between them. Addie drinks deeply, trying to wash away the image of the tree, knowing no amount of wine will cleanse her memories. It doesn't stop her from trying. Somewhere along the Seine, a violin begins to play. Under the high notes, she hears the tremor of a car's engine, the stubborn clop of a horse, the strange music of Paris. Luke lifts his glass.
"Happy anniversary, my Adeline."
She looks at him, lips parting with their usual retort, but then stops short. If she is his, then by now, he must be hers as well.
"Happy anniversary, my Luke," she answers, just to see the face he'll make.
She is rewarded with a raised brow, the crooked upturn of his mouth, the green of his eyes shifting in surprise. Then Luke looks down, turns the glass of port between his fingers.
"You told me once that we were alike," he says, almost to himself. "Both of us lonely. I loathed you for saying it, but I suppose in some ways you were right. I suppose," he goes on slowly, "there is something to the idea of company."
It is the closest he has ever come to sounding human.
"Do you miss me?" she asks. "When you are not here?"
Those green eyes drift up, the emerald even in the dark.
"I am here with you more often than you think."
"Of course," she says. "You come and go whenever you want. I have no choice but to wait."
His eyes darken with pleasure.
"Do you wait for me?"
And now it is Addie who looks away.
"You said it yourself. We all crave company."
"And if you could call on me as I call on you?"
Her heart quickens a little. She does not look up, and that is why she sees it, rolling toward her on the table, a slim band carved of pale ash wood. It is a ring. It is her ring, the gift she made to the dark that night, the gift he scorned and turned to smoke. The image conjured in a seaside church. But if it is an illusion now, it is an exceptional one. Here, the notch where her father's chisel bit a fraction too deep. There, the curve rubbed smooth as stone by years of worrying. It is real. It must be real. And yet, you destroyed it.
"I took it," says Luke, looking over his glass. "That is not the same thing."
Anger flares in her.
"You said it was nothing."
"I said it was not enough, but I do not ruin beauty without reason. It was mine for a time, but it was always yours."
Addie marvels at the ring.
"What must I do?"
"You know how to summon gods."
Estelle's voice, faint as a breeze, "You must humble yourself before them."
"Put it on, and I will come." Luke leans back in his chair, the night breeze blowing through those raven curls.
There, he says. Now we are even.
We will never be even,
she says as she turns the ring over between finger and thumb and decides she will not use it. It is a challenge, a game parading as a gift, not a war so much as a wager, a battle of wills. For her to don the ring, to call on Luke, would be to fold, to admit defeat, to surrender. She slips the token into the pocket of her skirts, forces her fingers to let go of the talisman. Only then does she notice the tension in the air that night. It is an energy she's felt before but cannot place until Luke says,
"There is about to be a war."
She had not heard. He tells her of the Archduke's assassination, his face a mask of grim displeasure.
"I hate war,"
he says darkly.
"I would have thought you fond of conflict."
"The aftermath breeds art," he says. "But war makes believers out of cynics, sycophants desperate for salvation, everyone suddenly clinging to their souls, clutching them close like a matron with her finest pearls."
Luke shakes his head.
"Give me back the belly pock."
"Who knew gods were so nostalgic?"
Luke finishes his drink and rises.
"You should leave before it starts."
Addie laughs. It sounds almost as if he cares. The ring sits, a sudden weight in her pocket. He holds out his hand.
"I can take you."
She should have accepted, should have said yes, should have let him lead her through the horrible dark and out again, and saved herself an ocean, a miserable week stowing away in the belly of a ship at sea, the beauty of the water tarnished by the unending nature of it. But she has learned too well to hold her ground. Luke shakes his head.
"You are still a stubborn fool."
She toys with staying, but after he is gone, she cannot help but conjure the shadows in his gaze, the grim way he spoke of the coming strife. It is a sign when even gods and devils dread a fight. A week later, Addie caves and boards a ship for New York. By the time she docks, the world is already at war. New York City, July 29th, 2014. 2. It is just another day. That is what Addie tells herself. It is just a day, like all the others, but of course it is not. It is 300 years since she was meant to be married, a future given against her will. 300 years since she knelt in the woods and summoned the darkness and lost everything but freedom. 300 years. There should be a storm, an eclipse, some way to mark the monument of it. But the day dawns perfect and cloudless and blue. The bed is empty beside her, but she can hear the soft shuffle of Henry moving through the kitchen, and she must have been gripping the blankets because her fingers ache, a knot of pain in the center of her left palm. When she opens her hand, the wooden ring falls out. She brushes it off the bed as if it were a spider, an ill omen, listens to it land and bounce and roll away across the hardwood floor. Addie draws up her knees and lets her head fall forward on them and breathes into the space between her ribs and reminds herself it is just a ring and it is just a day. But there is a rope inside her chest, a dull dread winding tighter, telling her to go, to put as much distance between her and Henry as possible, in case he comes. He won't, she tells herself. It's been so long, she tells herself. But she doesn't want to take the chance. Henry's knuckles rap on the open door, and she looks up to see him holding a plate with a donut, three candles stuck into the top. And despite everything, she laughs. What's this?
Hey, it's not every day that your girlfriend turns 300.
It's not my birthday.
I know, but I didn't exactly know what to call it.
And just like that, the voice rises like smoke inside her head.
Happy anniversary, my love.
Make a wish, says Henry.
Addie swallows and blows the candles out. He sinks onto the bed beside her.
I've got the whole day, he says. Bee's covering at the store, and I thought we could take the train out to...
But he trails off when he sees her face.
What?
Dread claws at her stomach, deeper than hunger.
I don't think we should be together, she says. Not today.
His face falls.
Oh.
Addie cups his cheek and lies.
It's just a day, Henry.
You're right, he says. It's a day. But how many of them has he ruined? Don't let him take it from you.
He kisses her.
From us. If Luke finds them together, he will take more than that.
Come on, insists Henry. I'll have you back long before you turn into a pumpkin. And then, if you want to spend the night apart, I understand. Worry about him in the dark, but it's hours until then, and you deserve a good day, a good memory.
And he's right. She does. The dread loosens a little in her chest.
Okay,
she says, one little word, and Henry's whole face lights with pleasure.
What do you have in mind?
He disappears into the bathroom, reemerges in a pair of yellow swim trunks, a towel cast over one shoulder. He tosses her a blue and white bikini.
Let's go.
Rockaway Beach is a sea of colored towels and flags planted in the sand. Laughter rolls in with the tide as kids make castle mounds and people lounge beneath the glaring sun. Henry stretches their towels out on a narrow patch of unclaimed sand, weights them down with shoes, and then Addie grabs his hand and they run down the beach, the soles of their feet stinging until they hit the damp line of the tide and plunge into the water. Addie gasps at the welcome brush of the waves, cool even in the heat of summer, and wades out until the ocean wraps around her waist. Henry ducks his head beside her and comes back up, water dripping from his glasses. He pulls her to him, kisses the salt from her fingers. She slicks the hair from his face. They linger there, tangled together in the surf.
See, he says, isn't this better?
And it is. It is. They swim until their limbs ache and their skin begins to prune, and then retreat to the towels waiting on the beach and stretch out to dry beneath the sun. It's too hot to stay there long, and soon the scent of food wafting from the boardwalk is enough to draw them up again. Henry gathers his stuff and starts up the beach, and Addie rises to follow, shaking the sand from her towel. And out falls the wooden ring. It lies there, a fraction darker than the beach, like a drop of rain on a dry sidewalk. A reminder. Addie crouches down before it and sweeps a handful of sand over the top before jogging after Henry. They head for the stretch of bars overlooking the beach, order tacos and a pitcher of frozen margaritas, savoring the tang and the sweet salted chill. Henry wipes the water from his glasses, and Addie looks out at the ocean and feels the past fold over the present, like the tides.
Déjà vu, déjà su, déjà vécu.
What is it?
Asks Henry. Addie glances toward him.
You get this look on your face, he says, when you're remembering.
Addie looks back out at the Atlantic. The infinite hem of the beach, the memories spooling out along the horizon. And as they eat, she tells him of all the coasts she's seen, of the time she ferried across the English Channel, the white cliffs of Dover rising from the fog, of the time she sailed the coast of Spain, a stowaway in the bowels of a stolen boat, and how, when she crossed to America, the whole ship fell ill, and she had to feign sickness so they wouldn't think she was a witch. And when she gets tired of talking and they have both run out of drinks, they spend the next few hours bouncing between the shade of the concession stands and the cool kiss of the surf, lingering on the sand only long enough to dry. The day goes by too fast, as good days do. And when it's time to go, they make their way to the subway and sink onto the bench, sun-drunk and sleepy as the train pulls away. Henry takes out a book, but Addie's eyes are stinging, and she leans against him, savoring his sun and paper scent, and the seat is plastic, and the air is stale, and she has never been so comfortable. She feels herself sinking into Henry, head lolling on his shoulder. And then he whispers three words into her hair. "I love you," he says, and Addie wonders if this is love, this gentle thing. If it is meant to be this soft, this kind. The difference between heat and warmth, passion and contentment. "I love you too," she says. She wants it to be true. Chicago, Illinois, July 29th, 1928. 3. There is an angel over the bar. A stained glass panel lit from behind with a single figure, chalice raised and hand outstretched as if calling you to prayer. But this is no church. Speakeasies are like weeds these days, springing up between the stones of prohibition. This one has no name, save the angel with its cup, the number 12 over the door. 12, the hour of midday and of midnight, the velvet curtains and chaises that lounge like sleepers round the wooden floor, the masks given to the patrons at the door. It is, like most of them, only a rumor, a secret passed from mouth to liquored mouth. And Addie loves it. There is a wild fervor to this place. She dances, sometimes alone and sometimes in the company of strangers, loses herself in the jazz that rocks against the walls, rebounds, filling the crowded space with music. She dances until the feathers of her mask cling to her cheeks, and Addie is breathless and flushed, and only then does she retreat, falling into a leather chair. It is almost midnight, and her fingers drift like the hands of a clock up to her throat, where the ring hangs on a silver cord, the wooden band warm against her skin. It is always within reach. Once, when the cord snapped, she thought it lost, only to find it safe within the pocket of her blouse. Another time, she left it on a windowsill and found it hours later at her neck again. The only thing she doesn't lose. She toys with it, a lazy habit now, like curling a lock of hair around one finger. She skims the edge of the band with her nail, twirls it, careful to never let the ring slide over her knuckle. She has reached for it 100 times, when she was lonely, when she was bored, when she saw a thing of beauty and thought of him. But she is too stubborn, and he is too proud, and she is determined to win this round. 14 years she has resisted the urge to put it on, and 14 years he has not come. So she was right, it is a game. Another kind of forfeit, a lesser version of surrender. 14 years. And she is lonely, and a little drunk, and she wonders if tonight will be the night she breaks. It would be a fall, but it is not so great a height. Perhaps, perhaps. To occupy her hands, she decides to get another drink. She goes to the bar and orders a gin fizz, but the white-masked man sets instead a champagne glass before her. A single candied rose petal floats among the bubbles, and when she asks, he nods at a shadow in a velvet booth. His mask is made to look like branches, the leaves a perfect frame for perfect eyes. And Addie smiles at the sight of him. She would be lying if she said it was nothing but relief, a weight set down, a breath set free. "I win," she says, sinking into his booth. and even though he folded first, his eyes are bright with triumph.
How so?
I didn't call, and yet you came. His chin lifts, a study in disdain.
You assume I'm here for you.
I forget, she says, sliding into his smooth, low cadence. There are so many maddening humans around to swindle out of their souls. A wry smile tugs at perfect lips.
I promise, Adeline, few are as maddening as you.
Few? She teases. I'll have to try harder. He lifts a glass and tips it toward the bar.
The fact remains, you have come to me. This place is mine.
Addie looks around, and suddenly, it is obvious. She sees the markings everywhere, realizes for the first time that the angel above the bar has no wings, that the curls rising around his face are black, that the band she took for a halo might as well be moonlight. And she wonders what it was that drew her here the first time, wonders if they are like magnets, she and Luke, if they have circled each other for so long that now they share an orbit. It will become a hobby of his, these kinds of clubs. He will plant them in a dozen cities, tend them like gardens, and grow them wild. As plentiful as churches, he will say, and twice as popular. And long after the days of prohibition, they will still flourish, catering to many tastes, and she will wonder if it is the energy that stokes him, or if they are a grooming ground for souls, a place to ply and pry and promise, and in a way, a place to pray, albeit a different kind of worship.
So you see, says Luke, perhaps I win.
Addie shakes her head. It is only chance, she says. I did not call. He smiles, gaze falling to the ring against her skin.
I know your heart. I felt it falter.
But I didn't.
No,
he says, the word nothing but a breath.
But I was tired of waiting.
So you missed me, she says with a smile, and there is the briefest glimpse in those green eyes, a fracture of light.
Life is long and humans boring. You are better company.
You forget that I am human.
Adeline,
he says, a shade of pity in his voice.
You have not been human since the night we met. You will never be human again.
Heat flushes through her at the words, no longer pleasant warmth, but anger. I am still human, she says, voice tightening around the words as if they were her name.
You move among them like a ghost,
he says, his forehead bowing against hers.
Because you are not one of them. You cannot live like them. You cannot love like them. You cannot belong with them.
His mouth hovers over her own, his voice dropping to nothing but a breeze.
You belong to me.
There is a sound like thunder in the back of his throat.
With me.
And when she looks up into his eyes, she sees a new shade of green and knows exactly what it is, the color of a man off balance. His chest rises and falls as if it were a human thing. Here is a place to put the knife.
I would rather be a ghost.
And for the first time, the darkness flinches, draws back like shadows in the face of light. His eyes go pale with anger, and there is the god she knows, the monster she has learned to face.
Suit yourself,
mutters Luke, and she waits for him to bleed into the dark, braces for the sudden reaching void, expects to be swallowed up and spit out on the other side of the world. But Luke does not vanish, and neither does she. He nods at the club.
Go on then, he says. Go back to them.
And she would rather he had banished her, Instead, she rises, even though she's lost her taste for drinks, for dancing, for any kind of company. It is like stepping out of sunlight, the humid room gone cold against her skin as he sits there in his velvet booth and she goes through the motions of her night, and for the first time, she feels the space between the humans and herself and fears that he is right. In the end, she is the one to leave. And the next day, the speakeasy is boarded up and Luke is gone. And just like that, new lines are drawn, the pieces set, the battle started. She will not see him again until the war. New York City, July 29th, 2014. 4. The A train jostles Addie out of sleep. She opens her eyes just as the lights overhead flicker and go out, plunging the car into darkness. Panic surges like a current through her chest, the world beyond the windows dark, but Henry's hand squeezes hers. "It's just the line," he says, as the lights come on again and the train settles back into its easy motion, and she realizes when the voice comes on the intercom that they're back in Brooklyn, the last stretch of subway underground again, and when they get off, the sun is still safely in the sky. They walk back to Henry's, heat-logged and drowsy, shower off the salt and sand, and collapse on top of the sheets, wet hair cooling on their skin. Book curls around her feet. Henry pulls her against him, and the bed is cool, and he is warm, and if it is not love, it is enough. 5 minutes, he mumbles in her hair. 5 minutes, she answers, the words half plea, half promise, as she curls into him. Outside, the sun hovers over the buildings. They still have time. Addie wakes in the dark. When she closed her eyes, the sun was still high. Now the room is full of shadows, the sky a deep indigo bruise beyond the window. Henry is still asleep, but the room is too quiet, too still, and dread rolls through Addie as she sits up. She doesn't say his name, doesn't even think it as she climbs to her feet, holding her breath as she steps out into the darkened hall. She scans the living room, braced to see him sitting on the sofa, long arms stretched along the cushioned back. Adeline. But he's not there. Of course he's not there. It has been almost 40 years. He is not coming, and Addie is so tired of waiting for him. She returns to the bedroom, sees Henry on his feet, his hair a mess of loose black curls as he searches under the pillows for his glasses. "I'm sorry," he says. "I should have set an alarm." He unzips a bag, puts a change of clothes inside. "I can stay at B's. I'll..." But Addie catches his hand. "Don't go." Henry hesitates.
"Are you sure?"
She isn't sure of anything, but she has had such a good day she doesn't want to waste her night, doesn't want to give it to him. He has taken enough. There's no food in the apartment, so they get dressed and head over to the Merchant, and there's a sleepy ease to all of it, the disorientation of waking after dark, added to the effects of so long in the sun. It lends everything a dreamy air, the perfect end to a perfect day. They tell the waitress they're celebrating, and when she asks if it's a birthday or an engagement, Addie lifts her beer and says, "Anniversary." "Congrats," says the waitress. "How many years?" 300, she says. Henry chokes on his drink, and the waitress laughs, assuming it's an inside joke. Addie simply smiles. A song comes on, the kind that rises above the noise, and she drags him to his feet. "Dance with me," she says, and Henry tries to tell her that he doesn't dance, even though she was there at the fourth rail when they flung themselves into the beat, and he says that is different. But she doesn't believe him, because times change, but everyone dances. She has seen them do the waltz and the quadrille, the foxtrot and the jive, and a dozen others, and she is sure that he can manage at least one of them.
and so she draws him between the tables, and Henry didn't even know that the merchant had a dance floor, but there it is, and they are the only ones on it. Addie shows him how to lift his hand, to move with her in mirror motions. She shows him how to lead, how to twirl her, how to dip. She shows him where to put his hands and how to feel the rhythm in her hips, and for a little while, everything is perfect and easy and right. They stumble, laughing, up to the bar for another drink.
Two beers,
says Henry, and the bartender nods and steps away, comes back a minute later and sets down their drinks. But only one is a beer. The other is champagne, a candied rose petal floating in the center. Addie feels the world tip, the darkness tunnel. There is a note beneath the glass, written in elegant, sloping French. For my Adeline.
Hey, Henry is saying, we didn't order this.
The bartender points to the end of the bar.
Compliments to the gentleman over...
He starts, trailing off.
Huh, he says. He was just there.
Addie's heart tumbles in her chest. She grabs Henry's hand.
You have to go.
What?
Wait.
But there is no time. She pulls him toward the door.
Addie.
Luke cannot see them together. He cannot know what they have found.
Addie.
She finally looks back and feels the world drop out beneath her. The bar is perfectly still. Not empty, no. It is still brimming with people, but none of them are moving. They have all stopped mid-stride, mid-speech, mid-sip. Not frozen, exactly, but forcibly stilled. Puppets hovering on strings. The music is still playing, softly now, but it is the only sound in the place besides Henry's unsteady breath and the pounding of her heart. And a voice rising from the dark.
Adeline.
The whole world holds its breath, reduces to the soft echo of footfalls on the wooden floor, the figure stepping out of the shadows. 40 years, and there he is, unchanged in the ways she is unchanged, the same raven curls, the same emerald eyes, the same coy twist to the Cupid's bow mouth. He's dressed in a black button-down, the sleeves of his shirt rolled to the elbows, a suit jacket flung over one shoulder, his other hand hooked loosely in the pocket of his slacks. The picture of ease.
My love, he says, you're looking well.
Something in her loosens at the sound of his voice, the way it always has. Something at the center of her unwinds, release without relief. Because she has waited, of course she has waited, held her breath in dread as much as hope. Now it rushes from her lungs.
What are you doing here?
Luke has the nerve to look affronted.
It's our anniversary. Surely you haven't forgotten.
It's been 40 years.
Whose fault is that?
Yours, entirely. A smile tugs at the edge of his mouth, and then his green gaze slides toward Henry.
I suppose I should be flattered by the resemblance.
Addie doesn't rise to the bait. He has nothing to do with this. Send him away. He'll forget. Luke's smile drops away.
Please, you embarrass us both.
He carves a slow circle around them, a tiger rounding on its prey.
As if I don't keep track of all my deals. Henry Strauss, so desperate to be wanted. Sell your soul just to be loved. What a fine pair you two must make.
Then let us have it. A dark brow rises.
You think I mean to pull you apart? Not at all. Time will do that soon enough.
He looks to Henry.
Tick-tock. Tell me, are you still counting your life in days, or have you begun to measure it in hours? Or does that only make it harder?
Addie looks between them, reading the triumphant green in Luke's eyes, the color bleeding out of Henry's face.
She does not understand.
Oh, Adeline.
The name draws her back.
Humans live such short lives, don't they? Some far shorter than others. Savor the time you have left. And know, it was his choice.
With that, Luke turns on his heel and dissolves into the dark. In his wake, the bar shudders back into motion. Noise surges through the space, and Addie stares at the shadows until she's sure they are empty. Humans live such short lives. She turns toward Henry, who's no longer standing behind her, but slumped in a chair. Some far shorter than others. His head is bowed, one hand clutching his wrist where the watch would be, where it is somehow again. She is sure he didn't put it on, sure he wasn't wearing it, but there it is, shining like a cuff around his wrist. It was his choice. Henry, she says, kneeling before him.
I wanted to tell you,
he murmurs. She pulls the watch toward herself and studies the face. 4 months she's been with Henry, and in that time, the hour hand has crept from 6:30 to 10:30. 4 months and 4 hours closer to midnight, and she always assumed it would go around again. A lifetime, he said, and she knew it was a lie. It had to be. Luke would never give another human so much time, not after her. She knew, she must have known, but she thought perhaps he'd sold his soul for 50 or 30 or even 10. That would have been enough. But there are only 12 hours on a watch, only 12 months in a year, and he couldn't be so foolish. Henry, she says, how long did you ask for? Addie, he pleads. And for the first time, her name sounds wrong on his lips. It is cracked. It is breaking. How long? She demands. He is silent for a long time. And then, at last, he tells her the truth. New York City, September 4th, 2013. 5. A boy is sick of his broken heart, tired of his storm-filled brain. So he drinks until he cannot feel the pieces scraping together in his chest, until he cannot hear the thunder rolling through his head. He drinks when his friends tell him it will be all right. He drinks when they tell him it will pass. He drinks until the bottle is empty and the world gets fuzzy at the edges. It is not enough to ease the pain, so he leaves, and they let him go. And at some point, on the walk home, it begins to rain. At some point, his phone goes off, and he doesn't answer. At some point, the bottle slips, and he cuts his hand. At some point, he is outside his building, and he sinks onto the stoop and presses his palms against his eyes and tells himself it is just another storm. But this time, it shows no signs of passing. This time, there is no break in the clouds, no light on the horizon, and the thunder in his head is so damn loud. So he takes a few of his sister's pills, those little pink umbrellas, but they are still no match for the storm, and so he takes some of his own as well. He leans back on the rain-slicked stairs and looks up at the place where the rooftop meets the sky and wonders, not for the first time, how many steps from here to the edge. He isn't sure when he decides to jump. Perhaps he never does. Perhaps he decides to go inside, and then he decides to go upstairs, and when he reaches his door, he decides to keep going, and when he gets to the last door, he decides to step out onto the roof, and at some point, standing there in the pouring rain, he decides he doesn't want to decide anymore. Here is a straight path. A tarred stretch of empty asphalt, nothing but steps between him and the edge. The pills are catching up, dulling the pain and leaving behind a cotton quiet that's somehow even worse. His eyes drift shut. His limbs are so heavy. It is just a storm, he tells himself, but he is tired of looking for shelter. It is just a storm, but there is always another waiting in its wake. It is just a storm, but tonight it is too much, and he is not enough, and so he crosses the roof, doesn't slow until he can see over the side, doesn't stop until the tips of his shoes graze empty air. And that is where the stranger finds him. That is where the darkness makes an offer. Not for a lifetime, for a single year. It will be easy to look back and wonder how he could have done it, how he could have given away so much for so little. But in the moment, shoes already skimming night, the simple truth is that he would have sold his soul for less, would have traded an entire life of this for just a day, an hour, a minute, a moment of peace. Just to numb the pain inside his chest, just to quiet the storm inside his head. He is so tired of hurting, so tired of being hurt. And that is why, when the stranger holds out his hand and offers to pull Henry back from the edge, there is no hesitation. He simply says yes. New York City, July 29th, 2014. 6. Now it all makes sense. He makes sense. This boy who could never sit still, never waste time, never put off a single thing. This boy who writes down every word she says so she'll have something when he's gone, who doesn't want to lose even a single day because he doesn't have that many more. This boy she's falling in love with. This boy who will soon be gone. How? She asks. How could you give up so much for so little? Henry looks up at her, his face hollow. In that moment, he says, I would have given it for less. A year. It seemed like so long once. Now it is no time at all. A year and it is almost up, and all she can see is the curve of Luke's smile, the triumphant color of his eyes. They were not clever. They were not lucky. They were not slipping past his notice. He knew, of course he knew, and he let it come to this. He let her fall. Addie, please, says Henry, but she is already up, already moving across the bar. He tries to grab her hand, but he is too late. She is already out of reach, already gone. 300 years. She has survived 300 years, and in those centuries, there have been so many times when the ground gave way, moments when she could not catch her balance or her breath, when the world left her feeling lost, broken, hopeless. Standing outside her parents' house that night after the deal, on the docks of Paris, where she learned what a body was worth, Remy pressing the coins into her palm, soaked through at the ruined stump of Estelle's oak tree. But in this moment, Addie isn't lost or broken or hopeless. She is furious. She shoves her hand into her pocket, and of course, the ring is there. It is always there. Grains of sand flake from the smooth wooden surface as Addie slides the band over her knuckle. It has been 40 years since she last wore it, but the ring slips effortlessly on. She feels the wind, like a cool breath at her back, and turns, expecting to find Luke. But the street is empty. Empty, at least, of shadows and promises and gods. She twists the ring around her finger. Nothing. Show yourself! She shouts down the block. Heads turn, but Addie doesn't care. They'll forget her soon enough, and even if she weren't a ghost, this is New York, a place immune to the actions of a stranger in the street.
Damn it! She swears. She wrenches the ring from her finger and hurls it down the road, hears it bounce and roll. And then the sound suddenly drops away. The nearest streetlight flickers out, and a voice comes from the dark.
All these years, and you still have such a temper.
Something brushes her neck, and then a silver thread, thin as dewshine, the same one snapped so long ago, shimmers on her collar. Luke's fingers trail along her skin.
Have you missed me?
She turns to shove him away, but her hands pass straight through, and then he is behind her. When she tries a second time, he is as solid and unyielding as rock. Undo it, she snaps, striking his chest, but her fist barely grazes the front of his shirt before he takes her wrist.
Who are you to give me orders, Adeline?
She tries to pull free, but his grip is stone.
You know, he says, almost casually, there was a time when you groveled, pressed yourself against the damp forest soil, and pleaded for my intercession.
You want me to beg? Then fine. I beg you. Please, undo it. He steps forward, forcing her to step back.
Henry made his deal.
He didn't know.
They always know, says Luke. They just don't want to accept the cost. The soul is the easiest thing to trade. It's the time no one considers.
Luke, please. His green eyes gleam, not with mischief or triumph, but power, the shade of someone who knows they're in control.
Why should I?
He asks.
Why would I?
Addie has a dozen answers, but she scrambles to find the right words, the ones that might appease the dark. But before she can find them, Luke reaches out and lifts her chin, and she expects him to play out their old, tired lines, to mock her or ask for her soul. But he does neither.
Spend the night with me, he says. Tomorrow, let us have a proper anniversary. Give me that, and I'll consider freeing Mr. Strauss from his obligations.
His mouth twitches.
If, that is, you can persuade me.
It is a lie, of course. It is a trap, but Addie has no other choice. I accept, she says, and the darkness smiles and then dissolves around her. She stands on the sidewalk, alone, until her heart steadies, and then walks back into the merchant. But Henry is gone. She finds him at home, sitting in the dark. He's on the edge of the bed, the blanket still tangled from their afternoon nap. He stares ahead into the distance, the way he did that summer night on the rooftop after the fireworks. And Addie realizes that she is going to lose him, the way she has lost everyone. And she doesn't know if she can do it. Not again. Not this time. Hasn't she lost enough? I'm sorry, he whispers as she crosses to him. I'm so sorry, he says as she runs her fingers through his hair. Why didn't you tell me? She pleads. Henry is quiet for a moment, and then he says,
How do you walk to the end of the world?
He looks up at her.
I wanted to hold on to every step.
A soft, shuddering sigh.
My uncle had cancer when I was still in college. It was terminal. The doctors gave him a few months, and he told everyone, and do you know what they did? They couldn't handle it. They were so caught up in their grief, they mourned him before he was even dead. There's no way to unknow the fact that someone is dying. It eats away all the normal and leaves something wrong and rotten in its place. I'm sorry, Addie. I didn't want you to look at me that way.
She climbs into bed and pulls him down beside her.
I'm sorry,
he's saying, soft and steady as a prayer. They lie there, face to face, their fingers intertwined.
I'm sorry.
And Addie forces herself to ask,
How long do you have left?
Henry swallows.
a month.
The words land like a blow on tender skin.
A little more, he says. 36 days. It's after midnight,
Addie whispers. Henry exhales.
Then 35.
Her grip tightens around his, and his tightens back, and they hold on until it hurts, as if any minute someone might try to pull them apart, as if the other might slip free and disappear.